It's Wednesday, May 15th, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, making the newspaper public property. Quite literally, we'll talk about a library tax measure that could lead to the creation of a new local news producer. The myth of the uneven playing field. We'll talk about the decision from the Court of Arbitration for sport, the coverage surrounding it, and the choice to potentially strip Olympic athletes of their ability to compete as women. And we'll talk about that op-ed in the New York Times from one of Facebook's co-creators in which he said it's too much and it's time to break up that company. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well before our half hour is up today. But let's start with the release of video taken by Sandra Bland using her cell phone of her arrest back in 2015 during a traffic stop. I want to warn you, this might not be the best for sensitive members of our audience.
Get out of the car, now!
Why am I being apprehended? You trying to give me a ticket for your failure?
Get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended? You just opened my car door. You just opened my car door. So you're threatening to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car!
And then you're going to stun me?
I will light you up. Get out!
Wow.
Now!
Wow.
Get out of the car!
Really, for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for a failure to
signal. Get over there.
Right, yeah. Yeah, let's take this to court. Let's do it.
Go ahead.
For a failure to signal. Yep, for a failure to signal.
Get off the phone.
On my school.
Get off the phone.
I'm not on the phone. I have a right to record. This is my property. This is my property. Sir?
Put your phone down right now.
Investigative reporter Brian Collister first got his hands on that video in 2017 through an open records request once the criminal and civil cases were closed. The public first saw it last week. That's the first question I have here. Why would it have taken 2 years for the public to get eyes on this after that reporter was able to get a hold of it?
I mean, I think this is one of the most serious questions of many surrounding the release of this video. I mean, first of all, the reporter, I could believe that he was the only one to follow up after all the cases had been settled. And so, you know, kudos to him for that. But that was a year and a half ago. And he even showed it to the family, he acknowledged himself, last fall. And here we are, you know, what, 10 months later, or last summer, 10 months later, and we're seeing the story for the first time. Is it because it's May sweeps? Is it because Brian Collister left the television station where he was when he got the video in the first place, and he was saving it for this new enterprise he started called Investigative News? I mean, I don't know. He hasn't addressed those questions, but it really looks a little bit odd to me.
Yeah, the thing that sort of jumped out at me was the fact that, if he thought to ask for this open record,
where was every other reporter in the state of Texas or across the country?
I mean, and you actually have some really good investigative reporters, whether you're talking about the Houston Chronicle, Dallas Morning News.
KHOU-TV is a legacy investigative
absolutely.
Outlet.
The Texas Tribune. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got so many outlets there that, you know, could have requested that and they didn't. I mean, especially in light of everything that we've seen over the, you know, going all the way back to what happened in New York. And I just can't understand for the life of me why somebody wouldn't say, wait a minute, is there some video there, either the police officer's video or the person that was arrested's video? Because everybody's always looking for video.
They had the dash cam video, and that was right. Part of the case the prosecutors filed against him. But they apparently didn't. Well, there's some question as to whether the prosecutors turned over the cell phone video.
And there's some really dramatic video that you can see on our links blog from Collister's. I think it's like a 9.5-minute report that he has. It's as part of going to be what he uses to launch this television-style investigative network that he's publishing online and hoping to someday work with and license some of those stories. And in that, there's some really dramatic video of him showing it to the Bland family. Attorney who took on that civil case, who's saying it never made it to him in discovery. The government is saying that's in fact not the case.
Right. The Texas Department of Public Safety says that they gave that cell phone video to her attorney along with a lot of other discovery evidence all on one big hard drive. Now, did they hide it on that hard drive somewhere? Did the attorney simply fail to recognize the significance of it? Did the prosecution or the DPS feel like they should tell the attorneys for Sandra Bland that there's this cell phone video on there? I don't know, but for whatever reason, it looks genuine that both the lawyer and the family didn't realize that that tape existed.
Well, to me, going forward, I mean, this points out that, you know, as part of journalism education, that should be one of the key things that we train our students to do, which is you're going to ask for everything. You expect that there's going to be video. You need to make sure you ask for that video. What was the chain of command in terms of who took the video and what are they using it for? All of those things need to be asked. But even going more so than that, I'm thinking about on the law enforcement side. Are there training programs right now to train officers how to deal with the public? Because, you know, in that situation, it appears that he escalated the whole process by pulling out his taser, you know, saying, get out of the car. And she kept saying, you pulled me over for a traffic signal. Why are we now escalating this to get out of the car with your hands up and place them on the hood of the car? I mean, there needs to be some sort of follow-up on whether or not there's some sort of training going on here.
And there's supposed to be, because actually the Texas legislature passed and the governor signed after Sandra Bland's suicide, passed a law that said there had to be improvements in training for law enforcement. It'd be a good time to go back and see how that's being carried out.
Right.
Okay, well, people across the country, they have all eyes on Georgia, among other states. We've got Alabama, we've got Ohio. We have what's going on right here in Missouri. Georgia, though, it's where the state's abortion bill, set to go into effect January 1st, was signed into law, and it outlaws the procedure after the detection of a fetal heartbeat. Five production companies have now announced that they will cease production in that state, including those belonging to David Simon and Mark Duplass. Actress and activist Alyssa Milano has called for a sex strike, but the major motion picture studios, they're staying quiet. And some of the bigger projects that have been filmed there, I have a list here that I want to go through. There's The Walking Dead on AMC, the show Ozark, and Stranger Things on Netflix, both Black Panther and Avengers Endgame. Georgia offers some of the most generous tax benefits in the state, and I'm going to read these because there's some specific numbers here. They give up to 30% in cash back. There were 455 productions filmed there in the last year, and it led to an estimated $2.7 billion with a B in direct spending to that state. A spokesman for the Motion Picture Association says that while there have been bills in other states, that have become laws, those have been enjoined, and the Motion Picture Association is waiting to see what the courts do before making any decisions.
I mean, that's a logical argument. I mean, you can see, though, that it goes without saying that the major Hollywood studios, the TV companies, mm-hmm. The streaming services, they're almost entirely white men at the top. So right. Would it be surprising that maybe they're hedging their bets on what to do because they're maybe not as sensitive to the concerns that some of the actresses, like you mentioned,
Alyssa
brought
Milano.
It up before.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, Georgia has a lot besides the tax breaks. It has a big city, plus it has a lot of urban areas. It's in the South. You can do a lot of filming. They have they don't have strong union in the South, so there's tens of thousands of employees in Georgia, so it would disrupt an awful lot, especially considering sometimes these contracts for production have to be set a year or more in advance to film shows and movies. So they're not inclined to want to do anything despite, for the most part, being good Hollywood liberals. There's a business enterprise here that they're concerned
about. Yeah, and
about.
I think it does go back to the business, but the other issue here is that Georgia is one of those states where you have the city of Atlanta and all of that metropolitan area and the diversity and the cosmopolitan part of it, and then you have the rest of Georgia. And this bill, which is now law, was passed by the rest of Georgia. And it's one of those issues that you're going to see in a lot of of states where you have big metropolitan areas that are trying to sort of be more progressive, but they're in states where, you know, that progressivism is just doesn't happen it out in what we call the hinterlands. I mean,
right here in Missouri, that bill is being debated today.
Right.
You know, we're in Boone County where we're a donut hole, a blue donut hole in the red state with the two poles in St. Louis and Kansas City.
Right, right.
It's interesting too, from a media standpoint, that you have some folks who are in Hollywood who are trying to split the difference. So you have producers, directors like J.J. Abrams and Jordan Peele who, well, they've got their contracts and they want to do their shows in Georgia, but they're offering to give a part of their revenue over to women's organizations as a way to try to have it both ways. I don't know if that will be successful. I think what will really matter is how quickly the courts decide whether or not Georgia's law is constitutional.
Right.
Which becomes the next big battle is.
I mean, ultimately, these laws were written as a way to force the Supreme Court to re-adjudicate the Roe versus Wade. I mean, that's where they ultimately want us to go.
Okay, so let's shift gears and talk about libraries. Funny, I was in a meeting a few weeks back and I brought up the idea of libraries, and somebody in that meeting asked me if I was referring to the place with the books. I tried not to laugh at him when he said that, but my answer was only sorta. I was referring to the taxpayer community centers that deal in information. So yeah, it was a dramatic response, but I thought back on it and I had to laugh when I heard what's happening in Longmont, Colorado. Taxpayers there are being asked to fund a new library district, and if approved, a new governmental subdivision would be created to operate a community library, and as part of that library's operation, would be a community news component. The vision here is still pretty muddy, but the idea would be to set up a multi-platform newsroom based out of the library, because where better than a place that deals in information and fighting the idea of misinformation?
No, I would agree with you. Conceptually, where better? I mean, I even think about my own career arc. I grew up in a little small town in Illinois, and if it weren't for the public library, I probably wouldn't be a journalist. I mean, this is the place where librarians have a lot in common with journalists. I mean, they care about the truth. They care about deep dives into information and education. And frankly, they sometimes have more nuanced materials in libraries for you to consider than the typical local news organization would. So it's not a bad idea in principle. There's a lot of questions I have about its practicality.
Well, and that's where, I mean, number one, you know, are you going to be bringing in enough tax dollars to actually make this work? Number two, when you start hiring staff for this, I mean, if you're hiring journalists, I mean, how is that going to play out when you have taxpayer dollar coming in? In terms of how they get paid, who are they loyal to? Are they loyal to the journalism, or are they loyal to, you know, the taxpayers themselves, or the city council, the government entity that is actually, you know, writing their check?
Bosses, right?
I mean, so yeah, I mean, you've got some real sort of ethical issues that float.
We shouldn't try to draw a really bright line here, because I mean, look at the radio station. It's the primary carrier of this program. Mm-hmm. They get tax money and they still are able to maintain editorial independence.
But that's not their entire funding model.
Well, and it's not necessarily true that a library is also funded only by taxpayers. There are lots of wealthy patrons in communities that give money to libraries. I worry about in the less affluent communities with a lower tax base, where in many instances we really need an alternative to traditional community-based newspapers or radio stations. Can they afford to do something like this?
Yeah, that would be my, where I would see, again, you have the haves and the have-nots, and the haves who are able to do what Mike is talking about in terms of not just taxpayer but also donations. They would have the access to the information and that information coming to them, whereas you have these small communities, which we talk about all the time, that are more and more becoming news deserts. And here's an opportunity for them to be able to do something. But if they don't have the tax base just to do what they're doing now, how would they even think about trying to do something like this?
I thought, too, Amy, that you raised an interesting question about whether or not there's a trade-off between having a local news source you could depend on and perhaps not having an editorial voice anymore, because, you know, if it's funded by the government, do you want to be doing that? And I actually don't think that's necessarily a bad trade-off. There are plenty of places to get opinion, commentary, editorials, whatever, today. There aren't a lot of places you can get quality local news content. And if a library had to make a trade-off, that might not be a bad one.
Yep. Okay, so let's turn our attention then due west to Salt Lake City, Utah, where the owner of the Salt Lake Tribune is seeking federal approval from the IRS to change the company from a privately owned business to a community asset. So if this happens and it becomes a nonprofit organization, this will be the first legacy news publication, the first legacy newspaper to make that switch.
Yeah, I mean, this I find interesting because, I mean, the Salt Lake Tribune is one, is the, I would say, the only paper in Utah that is independently owned. It's not, of course, the other newspaper is connected to the Mormon Church. And so what I think what Huntsman is trying to do here is say, look, in order to maintain our independence, we need to go to a nonprofit model. We need to sort of be like a Texas Tribune or something like that in order to be able to have that sort of independence that gives the citizens of the state of Utah a independent voice that is not connected to the government, nor is connected to the Mormon Church.
And it is odd because, as you say, there's a commercial enterprise operated by the Mormon Church. Right. It's their direct competitor.
Right.
There aren't that many cities that have two newspapers competing against each
other.
They
have local ownership, too. I mean, the Mormon Church is based in Salt Lake City.
Absolutely.
Even if the church does own the newspaper, that is still a two-newspaper town with local ownership for both. Right.
But if Huntsman convinces the IRS to allow them to be a nonprofit, is that unfair competition against the Deseret News? I don't know. The IRS regulations make it very hard for a for-profit company to suddenly become a nonprofit. I mean, there's an educational, you know, exemption, so to speak,
right,
in the law.
Right.
But what, about 10 years ago, as I remember, there was a member of Congress, or maybe it was a senator, who had proposed a bill to exempt local news organizations and allow them to become nonprofits under the IRS statutes, and that went nowhere.
Right.
Now, that was 10 years ago. Things have gotten progressively worse for community news organizations. Maybe that changed.
So is this, in your mind, a way to keep the newspaper, a way to keep it locally controlled, if not locally owned, so as not to have to sell out to a Gannett or to a Gatehouse or some of the corporate entities that have been known to kind of dive bomb in and destroy the local flavor of that local paper?
This may be what Huntsman's trying. I would say that it's probably his way or his family's way of trying to be able to keep this newspaper going. I mean, because there may not be a buyer there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there may not be an Advance or any of the other Gannett or any of the others who want to go in and do battle with
the
Deseret the News. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could be a losing proposition there for them, and they're like, you know, we don't want to do that. But this may be Huntsman saying, okay, here's an opportunity, here's an option that we haven't really thought about.
There is one other thing that was going to be part of this, that the print edition under this plan would continue, that it's going to be seen, and that every, you know, as this becomes a public entity, that they're going to give away digital subscriptions as a gift, and then that there would still be print editions as well. Likening that, and Mike and I are both kind of making faces because we spend so much of our time doing the membership drives here on KBIA, because they're likening it in a lot of ways to the premiums that stations like ours and others across the country give out to people who make their micro donations of $5 or $6 a month. My first thought, though, is like, that canvas tote bag, I keep thinking of the Nina Toten bag that we had in the last pledge drive, that tote bag is kind of a one-time expense. We here at KBIA make that purchase from NPR, from wherever we get those premiums, one time, and the listener gets their tote bag. This isn't a daily newspaper that continues to have costs associated with it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's just so many questions like that, and I don't want to throw cold water on any of these experiments because
we've got to do something.
Like,
give them credit for thinking about how they do this. So that idea of thinking about how we serve our communities and continuing to experiment and get other voices involved in our coverage, it's an important one to keep considering and find ways to serve them best. Well, I want to juxtapose that with a study from the Pew Research Center that shows that only two in 10 Americans say they have ever talked to a local journalist. And most of those who have, well, they tend to be older, wealthy, and white. Some of the other highlights that were in, or you could call them lowlights, that were in this study about the lack of penetration of local reporters in markets.
Does it surprise any of us around this table about the lack of diversity and when it comes to people who are interviewed? No, but the data is still useful from that standpoint and from a couple of others, I would argue.
I mean, it just seems that, you know, as much as we talk about it, as much as we preach about it, as much as we try to teach our students how to do this, it's just not manifesting itself in the journalism that we practice. I mean, we keep saying go out and talk to people whose lives are being impacted by the decisions being made by those in power, who, as we talk about all the time, are mainly white, they're mainly male. But we continue to see over and over again in our coverage that they go back to that same sort of demographic. You talk to the people in power, but not the people who are actually being impacted by the decisions that they're being made.
I thought there were a couple of other aspects of this story that were equally interesting to me. I don't know, maybe as important, but interesting. One was a speculation by the authors of the report that maybe journalists now are relying less on real human sources that they call up and interview, and more on social media. I can see that argument is true, and that's a problem for journalism.
One of my anecdotes from when I used to teach reporting is I've seen this with our students who are younger and have very different habits than I did when I was reporting, and both of you did at that point in your career as well. They're very much used to sitting behind the computer, looking things up online, looking through social media feeds to find sources or to find information. And I had a student who came up to me and said, I'm having a really hard time finding what we call our central compelling character, a real person, the person impacted by these policy decisions for my story. Do you have any ideas? Do you know what I can do? And I said, oh, I do. Like, he got really excited when I said this. I said, I have a whole book full of them. And he was like, really? Where's that book? And I pointed at the phone book and told him to go open it up and just start calling people and talking to people. That's part of it, too, is I think we have a new generation that's afraid to pick up the phone or to get out there and start knocking on doors in ways that we did.
I wouldn't necessarily say that they're afraid. Okay. They just don't know how.
Okay.
I mean, it's not something that they do. I mean, they communicate through text messaging, mm-hmm. through Twitter, through Instagram, through all these other social media platforms. So actually having a face-to-face conversation with someone
that they don't know. The anxiety. That's where the fear comes from. It's anxiety that comes from having to talk to an actual stranger, which is a scary proposition.
I agree with that. But before we get to rose-colored glasses I will say there's also something in this study that suggests maybe people have disincentives to talk to us anymore. I mean, if you say anything controversial, you could be stalked, harassed online and physically. So maybe it's not such a good idea to talk to journalists unless you have a really strong incentive to do so.
I mean, I think you have a very good point there. I mean, what we see in terms of the stalking that goes on, or the negative comments, or the trolling that happens. I mean, you know, people go like, wait a minute, if you're going to use my name, I don't want to be engaged. And I think it has gotten to the point where they're just saying they don't want to talk to the media for that fear of what the backlash is going to be, even when you have something that's compelling to say, or you want to be able to tell your story about how something that government or whatever entity is doing to you and how that has an impact on your life. It may come across in a way that may not be positive towards you. Therefore, I just won't talk.
Which brings another level of nuance to the trust issues that journalists have right now. Right. So let's switch it up a bit just once more and talk about Facebook yet again. This time it's not about something that it did or something it didn't do. It's about a call from one of the co-founders to dismantle the tech giant. Here's Chris Hughes talking to NBC News.
I'm angry at Mark, and I'm angry at a lot of Facebook's leadership for taking something that held so much promise and could have been so amazing and sacrificing quality, security, civility for clicks. And I think that it's time to hold them accountable.
So he wrote this op-ed in the New York Times. He's been doing the media tour, talking to all of the networks. Facebook has been growing like honeysuckle for a decade and a half. Why now? Where's he been all this time, and why is he calling for it now?
Maybe he thinks that his additional perspective will add to the weight and maybe tip the scales in favor of more regulation of Facebook. I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with his primary premises. I mean, Facebook is too big for innovation. Facebook is too big for privacy concerns. It's too big for free speech. I mean, all those things are probably true. I just wonder, one, whether or not our federal government has the wherewithal to actually do this. And I also wonder whether it will make a difference. I mean, because regulating these tech companies is a totally different beast than some monopolies in the past.
Well, and it looked like Josh Hawley was going to start to take a small step toward that yesterday and sending a letter to Zuckerberg asking for a clear sense of exactly what this pivot to privacy was going to mean and how that would protect consumers.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of things. We've talked about it on the show. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, is Facebook too big to fail? And now that's sort of pivoted. Is Facebook too big to be allowed to continue to do what it's doing because it controls so many aspects of it? But when you think about it, right now, our governmental structure is, and the politics in both in front of it and behind it, is not set up for dismantling companies like Facebook. I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, we have deregulation, which led to a lot of the monopoly within the airline industry, and now they're talking about trying to do that with tech. Or at least trying to break that up. That I just don't see that happening because we don't have the political will to actually do the kind of regulatory work that they're calling for.
Although I will say, even just the pressure, the threat of more regulation or some antitrust action is causing Facebook to at least publicly attempt or be perceived as attempting to make change. Look what happened just this week with saying that they were going to make it harder for people to use Facebook video to put out, you know, hate speech or terroristic activity. Now, I don't know how well that gets carried out, but I bet you a dollar it wouldn't have happened without the pressure that is there. That being,
and I think the monetary pressure that's coming from the European Union is also playing a role in this.
But I will say, too, I mean, if you want to look at what he's talking about in particular, you can like some of his ideas and not all of them. He says, well, make them divest Instagram and WhatsApp. Okay, I think we could probably see that. He says, let's have a new government agency that's going to decide what can be censored on social media.
I'm not so sure about that.
How does that happen? Okay, so we only have about a minute and a half before the show's up. So I very quickly want to ask you about a decision that came down this week from the organization that kind of regulates athletics, specifically the Olympics as well, challenging what female athletes can participate in. And for many, this was a very jarring decision.
I think this is an issue that it's not going to go away. Mm-hmm. It needs to be handled by the athlete, within the athletic community itself. And I don't think government regulation or this
intergovernmental
regulation is going to help at all.
Okay, well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'm sorry we didn't have more time to talk about that. Maybe we can bring it back next week. I'd like to thank each of you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. You can find that under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments or questions, and see previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.